Wondery Plus subscribers can listen to Tides of History early and ad-free right now. Join Wondery Plus in the Wondery app or Apple Podcasts.
Leah, it has been way too long. When was the last time we did a minisode together?
Patrick, I can't be bothered to keep up with dates. There's too much stuff that's gone on.
Yeah, you're also super busy now. You're like a big deal.
I'm a small to medium deal at best.
I would say medium to large deal.
Thank you so much. I'm not a special. You can order at the Burger King, though, so...
That's true. You're not getting upgraded to giant size.
I'm not indulging in that part of American culture.
But that's one of my favorite parts of American culture, Leah. Just giant
like
everything.
That it's an option, yeah. I mean, I would be furious if it started, like, if I didn't have the option anymore.
Yeah, I mean, that is kind of the essence of being American, is knowing that the giant size is available even if you choose not to order it.
It makes you feel like you have way more power than you do.
That's true. Like within this really tightly delimited set of options, you can choose an obscenely large one.
Yeah, it kind of makes me feel like what royalty feels like all the time, because you snap your fingers and whatever you want in whatever size and quantity is there. Like, shout out to Meghan Markle. She really worked her way up. Now, literally whatever she wants is right there.
Yeah, it must be nice to be a king.
Must be nice.
Speaking of kings, we just watched a movie about a king, didn't we?
Yes, we did.
Both of us. We both watched a movie. I can't believe I made it through a movie, Leah.
Oh my God, I made it through 3 hours of history.
That's kind of the question. So the movie that we watched is The King on Netflix. It stars Timothy with two E's,
yes.
Chalamet.
Yes.
Sad Boy King. Sad Boy King. And the question I think that should kind of guide our discussion of this movie is, to what extent is this history, or is there history in here?
I mean, I felt like I was seeing a lot of history, but I also see that I may be wrong.
Well, you've only edited how many episodes about the Hundred Years' War? Three?
A few.
There were a few episodes about the Hundred Years' War in there.
Although I am very familiar with the Battle of Agincourt. As a very French Robert Pattinson said in this movie.
Yeah, very French. He was doing a thing. He was really chewing the scenery.
Listen, I was into it.
I wasn't into it. He had kind of a weird, like, Tom Cruise in Interview with the Vampire thing going.
Totally.
And I'm here for it.
I guess this is a sidebar to the whole conversation because we haven't started it yet, but why is it that there are so many movies just, like, blatantly making fun of the French?
Easy targets.
Yeah.
Maybe. Definitely like a product of literal centuries of kind of Anglo-French enmity and often disgust.
Okay.
So I think we have like a deep well of cultural stereotypes to draw on, where like they're familiar enough that like you understand what's being made fun of without being so foreign that it feels like racist or something.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Yeah, that's kind of my sense.
All right. Well, let's talk about The King.
So did you like the movie?
Overall, I did. It's not a movie that I would have chosen. I only watched it on special request from Patrick Wyman. I don't do that for many people. Spend a night just watching a movie. And I'm glad that I did. I'm glad that I saw it. I do feel like I learned something, even if it was just about humans and how humans behave, which we've talked about a lot, how a lot of huge warfare, political acts just come down to interpersonal relationships and kind of the whim of whoever's in charge. And I thought the movie was really beautiful. Like, it was really beautifully shot, great locations, good acting, terrible accent from Timothée Chalamet. I'm like, what? This is not English, but it's also not American, and I'm not quite sure what you're doing. But other than that, I enjoyed it.
Yeah, I believe it was a descendant of the Kevin Costner in Robin Hood, Prince of Thieves accent
that he
just kind of abandons halfway through.
Yep.
It was in that genre, but not quite there. So, yeah, I share a lot of your sentiments. I really enjoyed the movie. I think if you're looking for a way to spend a few hours, you could do a lot worse than watching this. The performances were really good.
Mm-hmm.
I think like it was really well done. It's not a fast movie. It is not action-packed. There are scenes that involve an incredible amount of action and also an incredible amount of violence, which is something we'll come back to. But it's a deliberate movie. It takes its time getting you from point A to point B.
Yes. So to walk through it a little bit more explicitly, the king is focused on young Henry V.
Mm-hmm. Hal.
Yeah, Hal.
Prince Hal. And his growth from a wastrel, drunk youth into the greatest king of England.
The greatest king. So he's basically having to grow up a little bit.
Yep. It's a coming of age story and a becoming king story simultaneously. And so that's the story, right? And this is the sense in which it is not history, because the king is not the story of Henry V. It is an adaptation of a few of Shakespeare's history cycle plays, especially of Henry IV and Henry V, famous for Falstaff and the St. Crispin's Day speech in Henry V. So this is not an adaptation. This is not like a take on history. It's a take on Shakespeare.
Right. So I guess one of my questions is, why is this event and this one person's life so heavily dramatized? Because when Shakespeare wrote these, he was writing them almost 200 years after the events took place. It'd be like us sitting down to write a Civil War movie.
Yeah. So you have to understand the kind of the central place that the Battle of Agincourt especially holds in the English imagination. The Battle of Agincourt, in a lot of ways, it's kind of the high point of England as great power prior to the rise of the British Empire in the 18th and 19th century. And even then, it's still a central touchstone for what it means to be English. And it remains so to some extent today. Like, it's an important kind of thing for understanding what makes the English English, is English identity evolves in opposition to what it means to be French in the context of the Hundred Years' War. This is an argument that's been made by numerous historians, is that like the sense of what it means to be English is forged in the context of war, and it's forged in the context of a very long war. And so this is kind of the first stirrings of what we understand to be nationalism. And so the Battle of Agincourt and Henry V have a central role to play in that, which is what Shakespeare is drawing on, a sense of English history that is rooted in this particular conflict and this particular set of events and this particular unlikely victory, because Agincourt is an unlikely victory.
Right. They were outnumbered. The French had superior armor, technology, kind of bow and arrow. They used the crossbow to the English longbow. That was a big point once we got up to that battle. And then Henry's deal, Prince Hal wanted to unite England. Mm-hmm. Can you talk a little about that?
Yeah, so this is where we get into the more kind of explicit mythologizing. Like, yes, England was riven with conflict, and that, as the thing points out, in large part has to do with the reign of his father, Henry IV, who was a usurper, who took over from Richard II, locked him in a tower until he starved to death.
Ooh.
Richard II, not a good guy.
No.
Not a good guy by any stretch of the imagination. But so you've got these two kings who are following one of England's greatest kings, Edward III. Both of them are subpar in their own particular ways. Henry IV, because he had come into his position in the manner that he did, and Richard II, because he was a bad dude who was not a great king and was really focused on kind of personalizing his rule, and in the process of doing so, alienated a lot of people within England. So Henry IV's reign was not nearly as bad as it is made out to be in this.
Yeah, it looks pretty terrible.
Yeah, nobody really liked Henry IV that much. He was not like a beloved figure, but he was pretty good at being king, and he was pretty good at, for the most part, suppressing rebellion. He did have to deal with a whole bunch of stuff, but like Henry V, in contrast to the portrait here, was not so much at odds with his father as he's portrayed. Like, he was a pretty loyal supporter of his father's rule for the most part. There were conflicts there. There was tension. But it was the tension of a guy who knew he was going to succeed his father.
I see. So let's talk about the ways in which young Hal ascended to the throne then.
Yeah. So he was not, in reality, he was not the second choice, which is how he's portrayed here. He was going to be the guy. He had two younger brothers.
Okay. Because in this movie, yeah, that's his primary motivating force, is to prove that he is fit to be king, because he was not chosen and he's thought by the
Correct.
Public not to be worthy of the throne.
Yeah. So in reality, Henry was always the guy. And he had two younger brothers, John, Duke of Bedford, and Thomas, Duke of Clarence.
Thomas is featured in the movie. John is not.
Yes. John, Duke of Bedford, actually maybe had the most accomplished career outside of Henry V himself, John Duke of Bedford was effectively the English regent in France after Henry V dies so young, so unexpectedly. And he held the English kingdom and France together for more than a decade.
Wow.
More than anything else, the death of John Duke of Bedford was the beginning of the end for English rule in France. He was incredibly competent. He was a great soldier. He had a glittering court. He was personally charismatic, competent, a really key figure, like a, probably an underrated figure in how central he was to the events of the later Hundred Years' War. It's just that because that came to naught under Henry V's feckless son, Henry VI, John Duke of Bedford doesn't get that much attention paid to him because we know how the story ends. We know the story ends with the English being driven out of France.
Right.
Thomas Duke of Clarence was actually suicidally brave and did die in battle. He got himself into trouble because he was suicidally brave, but he dies much later on.
It seems like then for the purposes of this film and for dramatic storytelling, in which we take the facts and bend them to be a movie, nobody wants to see a movie where things don't happen. That's kind of the point. Mm-hmm. It seems like then that they've taken the qualities of these two brothers and pushed them all into young Hal.
Yeah, yeah. There's to some extent, yeah. And I think it, because it gives you dramatic tension, right?
Like, yeah.
That's what's going on here.
Do you ever wonder where all your money went? Like every single time you look at your bank account? Honestly, it's probably all those subscriptions. I felt that way too, until I got Rocket Money. Rocket Money helped me see all the subscriptions I'm paying for, and it was eye-opening. Between streaming services, fitness apps, delivery services, it all adds up so quickly. Rocket Money is a personal finance app that finds and cancels your unwanted subscriptions, monitors your spending, and helps lower your bills. Rocket Money has over 5 million users and has helped save its members an average of $720 a year, with over 500 million in canceled subscriptions. Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Cancel your unwanted subscriptions by going to rocketmoney.com/Wondery. That's rocketmoney.com/Wondery. rocketmoney.com/Wondery.
So in terms of what the movie gets right and wrong about Henry V, I think it grasps some of the essence of his character and reality. And this is always what's more important to me than like strictly getting the events right or the facts right is, does it get the feel? Does it capture something about these people? So like the Rome TV series is always a touchstone for me in this regard, because I think it captures something essential about ancient Rome. I think it captures something essential about the first emperor, Augustus, formerly Octavian, even without like getting the strict sequence of events like quote unquote, right? Like it's doing things to tell you a fun story, but I think it still gets some things right. And I think this still gets some things right about Henry. I think it gets his ambition as much as the character of first Hal and then King Henry in the movie is trying to disguise his ambition or is trying to like suppress it, is just trying to do what's right. He's still ambitious. That's still there. The whole time. That's an undercurrent, and it's a tension that gives the movie dramatic weight.
Sure.
Is this kind of battle within Henry himself where he just thinks he's doing what he's got to do, but really there's, you know, there's ambition there.
Right.
Which is kind of the devastating reveal at the end of the movie when his soon-to-be French bride just absolutely reads him.
Oh, man, that was amazing, because women are rarely given credit for the kind of backroom wheeling and dealing that we have talked about on this show before. We know that they did.
Yeah.
And, you know, the extent of their power is not fully felt, but you're influenced by the people you spend time with. And so if you're a king, whoever's your queen, whoever, you know, your inner court is, you're going to be influenced by them. So when Catherine, Hal's new peace bride, basically rips away everything he thought to be true about the events that we just saw in the movie, it was a great moment and really reinforced how, I mean, Charles says this, which is kind of basically the thesis of the film, which is, I wrote it down, we are leaders of lands and peoples, and yet family moves us, family consumes us, which we've talked about a lot on the show. Huge scale warfare, political moves are based on interpersonal drama.
Interpersonal relationships mattered
yes.
to medieval politics. And that is something correct. That is something that is part of the feel that this film gets right about this whole period, is that these personal slights, these personal injuries, insults, insecurities. These things matter to the kind of broad scale of how medieval politics played out in a way that can be hard for us to understand today. I think we would like to believe, just for our own sense of narrative and control, that those things matter a lot more than they do in present day politics. I think we would like to believe that individuals matter a lot more than they do in the present day. There are distinct ways in which individuals and personality mattered deeply structurally in medieval politics that is not necessarily the same case today.
Yeah.
But yeah, no, I'm glad that you wrote that quote down. I'm glad that you put it forward, because that is the thesis of the movie, that it is personal,
mm-hmm.
right? And that's what makes the Princess Catherine, the French bride, that's what makes her kind of reveal at the end of this so devastating, is that we understand in ways that have only kind of been hinted at how Henry has been deceived and how he has deceived himself and how he has wanted to deceive himself over the course of the movie about why he's doing the things that he's doing and exactly who he wants to be, right? Like, that's what makes it compelling for us to watch, and it's what makes it fun as a viewer. Like, really enjoyed this. I really liked the movie. I thought it was great.
I think you're right in that it really captures a real sense of what it means to be a person at that time, too.
Mm-hmm.
And I know we keep saying sad boy king, like making fun of it, because, you know,
he's Henry, kind of a sad boy.
He mopes around the whole movie, but he's also lost everyone he cares about. Mm-hmm. He's totally alone. He's what, 20?
His dad's an ass.
His dad sucks.
His brother really sucks.
His best friend dies. He's alone in the world. And you would be sad if that's happening to you. You would be probably very sad for a very long time. And it's not like low stakes. He's not an accountant. Like, the entire country is following him around and waiting for him to man up. And he has to find a way to do it.
Yeah. And this is something, again, that can't be emphasized enough about rule in this period. And as much as I like to talk about things like bureaucracy and structure and systems of political norms and rules and actors that extend way out from just the king, everything still revolves around the king.
Yeah.
There's a great visual metaphor Dan Jones used in his book on the Wars of the Roses that, like, everything revolves around the king. You may have a machine of bureaucrats and people who work in the exchequer and people who are out collecting taxes and doing this and doing that, but the machine only moves because it can be set in motion by the king.
Right.
Right. You need an active king at the center of that. Even if the king is making bad decisions, the king has to make decisions.
Right.
This is what makes Henry VI, Henry V's son, so devastating, was he just didn't do anything. He couldn't do anything. He was congenitally incapable of it. And that's the crisis that produces the Wars of the Roses, is people trying to act on behalf of the king when the king is the only one who can legitimately wield that power.
Sure.
So that's the conundrum that's at the heart of this, too, is that the king has to act. The king has to do things. The king has to make decisions. Those are devastating decisions. They have real consequences for real people. And there's blood and mud and death that comes about because of what the king does.
Yeah.
And that's the kind of dramatic tension of the movie.
Right. And so I guess to circle back to our central question, is this history? Mm-hmm. No, it's not.
Not in any meaningful sense.
No. I think, you know, we've talked about this a lot. To tell a story is to try to capture an emotional feeling, mm-hmm. and to try to, like we've talked about here, capture the essence of a thing. It's not going to be factual all the time. There can be a certain accuracy, but it's not history in the way that we talk about history on this show, because it's all about dramatic tension, conflict. It's about action. Mm-hmm. So like you said, we can't make a movie on Henry VI at all, because he's inactive. He's not making any choices.
Yeah. He is inert.
Yes. And that's the worst possible thing you can be. Even if you feel like you're failing and everything's falling apart around you, you're making choices. Mm-hmm. And that is what it takes to make a movie. And so, no, it's not history. It's a movie.
Yeah. And with that said, as I hope we've pointed out, there are things about this that feel real and true about the period. So the kind of weight of being king, the decisions that have to be made. And I really think it gets the violence right.
Yeah. Like, let's talk about the violence.
Yeah. So the action scenes in this movie are incredible.
They're good.
I think they're really, really, really good. They're some of the best kind of action scenes in a medieval setting outside of Game of Thrones, which I think is kind of the gold standard for medieval-y feeling mm-hmm. action. I think it's absolutely amazing, because it really gets at the slipperiness in a literal sense.
Yeah, good
there's
choice.
Mud. Like, there's mud everywhere in
yeah.
this. And when you read the most kind of visceral accounts, like firsthand accounts of medieval combat, there's always mud.
Yeah.
You know, like there's always mud there. Like I think the most kind of brutal account of a medieval fight is from much earlier than this, a few centuries earlier. But it's like these two knights are like fighting and they lose their weapons and they end up rolling on the ground. And one guy is just bashing the other in the groin by the end of it, just punching him as hard as he can in the groin. And they're like rolling and there's mud. And because it's in Flanders, like there's, of course,
what
there's going to be mud.
What a muddy place.
Just mud out the wazoo. But like this movie gets the mud.
Yeah.
You know, it gets that at some point you're going to end up on the ground covered in the muck, which is also a handy kind of metaphor for the theme of the movie too, right? Like you're always going to end up in the muck no matter what your principles are, no matter what you think you're doing, you're going to be covered in blood and mud by the end of it.
Right. And I think, you know, to extend this metaphor a little further, one of the things that I really liked about the fight scenes, because I'm not a gratuitous violence kind of person. I walked out of Jurassic World because those dinosaurs kept dying. I'm not going to sit there and just watch things be killed to be killed.
Mm-hmm.
So one of the things that I really enjoyed was how messy humans are and how really kind of mundane these things are.
Mm-hmm.
Like, yes, there is some really crazy violence, especially with the kids in the woods. If you watch the movie, you'll know what I'm talking about. But the fact that it is sweaty and awkward and it's not sexy and it's not super heroic and nobody's like leading a massive charge, because that's not how it works on an actual real day-to-day level. You're scrappy and somebody's way too close to your face and keeps hitting you, and like you can feel their breath and you can feel their sweat and then eventually their blood. That's gross and intimate, and that's how warfare was.
Yeah, there's a lot of daggers going through visors. And also, like, it's kind of interesting because I've spent a lot of time working on medieval warfare over the years, but like when you see them repeatedly hitting a guy in the head with a thing while he's on the ground, like you're hitting a guy in the head with a hammer while he's on the ground, or like repeatedly stabbing a guy in the face, it makes the wound patterns you see in medieval mass graves make a lot more sense, because there are always multiple head wounds.
Yeah.
Right? There's never just the one head wound. There's always like, no, we're going to make sure this guy's dead.
Well, yeah.
And suddenly that makes a lot more sense. Where you're like, oh, you don't just hit the guy once and he goes down. You keep hitting him until you're sure he's dead.
Yeah, or else he's going to get back up and hit you a bunch.
Yeah, so it's like, it was brutal. I mean, it's brutal to watch. And I say this as like a connoisseur of both real and filmed violence.
Yeah.
Like, I've spent a lot of time in my life like doing things that have to do with violence, and this was excellent depictions.
It was great, and it was brutal, but I was also able to watch it because it was real.
And it served grounded. A narrative purpose too,
it did.
Right?
It wasn't just killing to kill.
You're right. When you talked about it not being gratuitous, it was like, no, this is telling us something deep about the themes and the meaning that this movie is trying to convey.
Yes.
It felt of a piece.
Yeah.
And also, it was kind of masterfully handled in the context of the way the movie's paced, where it's, like I said, that it was deliberate. You could say slow.
I think you're right. I had said slow before when we were talking about it, but you're right. It's not slow. It is deliberate.
Because it's all different. about the kind of the narrative structure of the movie is built around the difference between these incredibly visceral, violent, quick-paced action scenes and the slow movement of character development and plot over the rest of it.
Yeah.
So, but yeah, I think we've pretty much hit what we need to hit there.
I think we recommend this movie.
Yeah, I think if you're interested in this period, which you presumably are because you're listening to the show, you will probably get something out of it. If you don't like violence at all, you probably shouldn't watch it. That's the caveat.
When it comes to hiring, don't go searching for the one. Just meet your match with Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform with over 350 million global monthly visitors, according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/match. Just go to Indeed.com/match right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Indeed.com/match. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
So there was one other thing that we were going to do in today's episode. Because Christmas is coming up soon, and because we're doing Black Friday and Cyber Monday here after you'll be listening to this, we're going to talk about some books that we recommend for the holiday season, books that you may read if you're going on a nice vacation. Please go someplace nice and warm, or things to get for the dad or grandpa in your life or the other avid history reader.
The women who read history.
Yeah, I say dad or grandpa because like 80 to 90% of the audience for popular history is male, but...
But here we are.
But here we are for the person in your life who loves history.
There we go.
There we go.
That's inclusive. Thank
yeah.
you.
Yeah, you're welcome. We've got some recommendations.
Lay them on me because I have a dad who loves history.
Okay, so I have two books that are medieval popular histories okay. that we've talked about on the show recently. Roger Crowley's The Accursed Tower and Dan Jones's Crusaders. I say this not just because we interviewed them and because—
They're very deep friends of the show.
And they're friends of the show. Multiple-time guests.
Yes.
Some of our only multiple-time guests on the show. But because these are the quintessential fun popular history book.
Right. I mean, we keep talking about these guys because they've figured it out.
Yeah, they're really good at what they do. As somebody who is currently writing a book, I can tell you that writing narrative history that appeals to a wide swath of people is quite difficult. Yeah. It is a difficult task. And so I have just ruthlessly mined both of these two people for their insights in person or directly whenever possible, and otherwise just by kind of cribbing from their books, because they are good at the task of writing popular history. They're good at story. They're good at narrative structure. They're good at character. And they're good at telling you some deep things about the past.
Okay, so what are both of these books about?
So The Accursed Tower is about the fall of Acre, the last Crusader stronghold in the Holy Land in 1291, the events that led up to it, why it matters in the broad scheme of things. Dan Jones's Crusaders is much broader in scope. It is about the Crusades as a whole, the people who went on Crusades, why they did it, and the broad scope of what crusading meant to people as a movement. So they both play to these individual authors' strengths. Like, Dan is really good at the broad scope of things and picking the particular people who are going to bring out something both universal and specific. Like, I think he did a masterful job of picking the characters that he worked with in this. What Roger Crowley does really well is focus on a kind of a single thing and bring you deep into that thing and give you a blow-by-blow account from the perspective of being there.
That's great.
Yeah. So they're very different books, even though they're both kind of about the Crusades.
Yeah.
They're very different books and very different kinds of reads.
Do either of these books assume that I've read other books?
No.
That these,
okay. Absolutely not.
So they're standalone.
Yes. You do not have to have read anything else.
Love that. I've never read a book in my life, so this is perfect.
Wonderful. Yeah, no, great place to start.
Wonderful.
You have read many books, or at least you've claimed to for the purpose of this show.
I'm sorry, what? I've been too busy listening to podcasts. Patrick, if I don't want to read a history book, do you have anything else that you can recommend?
I do. So one of my favorite books that I've read in the recent past is David Epstein's Range.
I've heard of this book.
Yeah. So I think that David Epstein is very smart. Imagine a deeper version of what Malcolm Gladwell does.
A response to Outliers, I think this book is.
Yes.
Yeah.
In a lot of ways, mm-hmm. yes. This book is about the benefits of broad experience. And what Epstein does is assimilate a vast amount of research in a bunch of different fields about the benefits of being able to think broadly, not just deeply and specifically, and why the world needs more generalists and people who can think broadly. Now, part of the reason I like this is because it kind of feel like it flatters me because I love being a generalist.
Yes.
So I am biased and predisposed to liking this. But also, I think it's a kind of a masterful way of doing a book like this. He's done it right. Like, he has done the research, he could engage with the specialists on these topics, and he has done a great job of communicating this research, and more than that, why it matters in a deep and compelling way. So if you're looking for a nonfiction read, it's not that long. I think it's like the audiobook's like 14 hours.
Great.
It's a great audiobook if you want to go on Audible and grab it. It's a good book to keep you busy, and it'll make you think about something. This book is not trying to change the way that you look at the world. It's trying to tell you something interesting that maybe could change your behavior a little bit. And that's all it's trying to do, and I think it succeeds admirably at that.
That's wonderful.
If you're looking for some fun fantasy fiction—
As I always am. Just kidding, I don't read.
The look on your face
I was
when
overjoyed.
I said that.
Could you see the tiny dragons flying through my brain?
I can see the tiny dragons, yeah. I got a little bit of a grimdark fantasy recommendation for you. Joe Abercrombie's First Law series, which begins with The Blade itself. These books are so much fun. So much action, kind of dark or low fantasy. I think if that's your thing, you could really enjoy these. If you like Game of Thrones, you'll probably like these books too.
Okay, great. Well, let me scamper off to my local library /audible.com to find them.
Yeah. One more recommendation for a more literary type of fiction, historical fiction, Hilary Mantel's Wolf Hall in the series that follows. So I love that book. It's about Thomas Cromwell, who was Henry VIII's right-hand man.
Friend of the show, Thomas Cromwell.
Yep. Somebody we've talked about a fair bit. And it is an incredible look into his imagined inner life.
Great.
It is all from his perspective. That's how it's framed. It's also one of my favorite miniseries of the recent years. It's on Amazon Prime if you want to watch it. It's incredible. I love me some Mark Rylance.
I love all these things.
Yeah. So these are our recommendations.
If you have any questions, don't ask them. Our word is law.
Please feel free to reach out to us.
Yeah. We're available for you.
Yeah. We're a resource even.
I would say we are a good resource.
Leah, thanks for doing this. Thanks,
Patrick,
for making the time in your busy schedule to hang out and chat.
Anytime. I'm happy to do it. I love Tides. I'll be here forever, I hope.
Yeah. Until the next time, thanks for joining us today. We'll chat soon. Thanks so much for joining me today. Be sure and drop me a line if you'd like to chat about the fall of the Roman Empire or the rise of the modern world. You can find me on Twitter at @Patrick_Wyman or on Facebook at @PatrickWymanMMA. You can follow the show at Tides History. If you haven't already, don't forget to subscribe to Tides of History on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Podcasts, Stitcher, or wherever you're listening to this right now. If you've been enjoying the show, I'd really appreciate it if you left a 5-star rating and a review. Tides of History is written and narrated by me, Patrick Wyman. The sound engineer is Sergio Enriquez. Tides of History is produced by Morgan Jaffe and Leah Sutherland. From Wondery, the executive producer is Hernan Lopez. Thanks again for listening. Until next time, from Wondery, this has been Tides of History.
If you travel, you know how to pull off a perfect getaway. You know, after you enroll with your Delta SkyMiles Platinum American Express card, you get up to $10 back monthly on U.S. rideshare purchases with select providers, like a car to the airport. You know which remote retreats have the best herbal baths and where the Wi-Fi password is rarely used, because you're the escape artist. It's why you're a Delta SkyMiles Platinum American Express card member. If you travel, you know. Terms apply. Purchases must be on card. Visit go.amex/you know.